Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 13 of Tim's Travails, where amazing Tim trainer, IP attorney, author, all-around amazing guy, former Army brat, interviews fantastic people throughout his career, attorneys often, such as today's guest. Ronald Sharp was the former U.S. Attorney of the Virgin Islands, and we're going to have a powerful conversation with what it means to have that job. Just a little background, Ronald is an experienced trial attorney with proven leadership who managed complex litigation matters and planned and implemented effective investigative and trial strategies. He is a former Jones Day law firm partner who practiced in the firm's investigations and white-collar defense group. During his tenure at Jones Day, Ronald worked out of the Washington office, focusing on white-collar defense, internal investigations, and the representation of corporations and individuals in connection with government enforcement actions. Fascinating. From September 2009 to March 2017, he served as the presidentially appointed U.S. Attorney for the District of the Virgin Islands. There, he led numerous high-profile criminal and civil investigations, including public corruption cases, implementing elective members of the Virgin Islands Senate, federal employees, and police officers, as well as significant financial fraud cases and international organized crime investigations. Holy moly, you are badass, man. All right, Tim, take it away.
Thank you, Hope. First of all, I got to thank Ronald for agreeing to be here today. And Ronald, good to see you again. It's been a little while, but thank you very much for being here today.
Tim, it's always good to see you. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
I think one of the things hopefully we can do today is, given sometimes the number of times maybe the topic of U.S. attorneys has been in the news the last several months, we can get a little bit of a different side of things from you, because you're the real deal. You not only were at Jones Day, but in the past, you were also actually a career attorney with the Department of Justice before becoming the U.S. attorney. So I think one of the things that might be interesting, given what some people read in the news, is actually the path, which is a bit interesting from your perspective, maybe going from career DOJ attorney to becoming U.S. attorney. I don't know how often that really happens. Because a lot of times people seem to, or at least I seem to think of U.S. attorneys as being plucked from maybe the private sector, big law firms, and not having come from the core of Department of Justice lawyers that are around the countries. So maybe you can inform us a little bit about that from your perspective and your route to becoming U.S. attorney in the Virgin Islands.
Sure. I think everything you said is true, Tim. In other words, there are certainly U.S. attorneys that have been plucked from the private sector. Many of them, though, and this is a broad overview, because I think everyone's path to U.S. attorney is a bit unique in and of itself. So, but there is a sort of a protocol to it. Those that have been plucked from private sector jobs typically have had some government experience. They may have served early in their career as an assistant U.S. attorney or as a prosecutor at DOJ, or in some other role, maybe at the state level, state or local level. I don't think it's really uncommon when you think about how many districts there are that have U.S. attorneys. There are actually 94 districts, 93 U.S. attorneys, with one district having, one U.S. attorney for two districts, I should say. That's Guam and the Northern Mariana Islands.
Oh, okay.
So my path, I'll tell you what I understand first about how most get the job of U.S. attorney. And this is a sweeping generalization. I'll give you that caveat up front. What I understand is that in most districts are in states. So yeah. Each state has two senators, and typically 3 to 5 names are submitted to the two state senators. They get together and decide which of these suggestions will be forwarded to the department to move up the path. There's typically a vetting process, extensive background checks, et cetera, et cetera. And then at some point, the president nominates one of these candidates right. with the advice of the state senators for whatever particular district is at issue. My path was different, as you pointed out earlier, Tim. I was an assistant U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, where I had served over a decade. I was actually a senior in the Fraud and Public Corruption section in the D.C. office. And I initially went down as the first assistant United States attorney, and that's second in command of the office. I'll tell you how I got that opportunity. I was working in the office. One of the executive assistants knocked on my door from the front office in D.C., and I was in a meeting with an FBI agent regarding one of my investigations, and she said, come see me after your meeting. And typically that means you're in trouble, but not this occasion. So I went to the office, and she told me that the main justice had called over to D.C., and they understood that there was a vacancy in the District of the Virgin Islands for the first assistant. Apparently the presidentially appointed had retired or resigned, which by protocol, the first assistant who's serving at the time moves up into the acting U.S. attorney's role.
Yeah.
And that left a vacancy in the office, and the department reached out to various offices, typically the bigger U.S. attorney's offices, New York, D.C., the big city offices, essentially. And so in the meeting with the executive assistant in D.C., it was explained to me that there's this opportunity in the Virgin Islands to be first assistant. We think you'd be a good candidate. So why don't you interview for it? And, you know, there was some hesitancy because I was deeply rooted in D.C. and things like that. So I talked it over with my better half, and I basically interviewed, and one thing led to the other. I got the job and went down in November of 2008 as first assistant U.S. attorney. And in less than a year, I was the United States attorney for the District of the Virgin Islands. So a little bit of a different path. And I should point out that initially I was the court appointed U.S. attorney. Because this gets in the weeds a little bit, but there's something called the Vacancy Reform Act.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it sets timelines in terms of how long an acting U.S. attorney can serve without there being someone in the pipeline who's being vetted for the presidential appointment for that district. And if there's no nominee in the pipeline, at some point the chief judge of the district court is entitled to appoint the U.S. attorney, and that's what happened in my case. There's a whole story behind that you know, we could spend the rest of our time today talking about how that transpired and why.
Yeah.
But that's a little bit off
subject
here, I think.
Yeah.
So, but it was a unique challenge, and I thought just going to the Virgin Islands was, you know, just interesting in a lot of ways and challenging in many also.
So given the fact that now that you're converting yourself from a career position to a presidentially appointed one, does that mean you officially have to resign your government position as a career attorney in order to become the presidentially appointed person?
Yes, you do. That's accurate. And that's a bit of, some folks don't want to do that. And that's very understandable because there are consequences to doing that. Not the least of which is, as a presidential appointee, you have to, you're basically signing up for a job that you know is temporary. You serve at the pleasure of the president, and you know the president is not going to serve forever. And in many cases, the president will not be in office through your targeted retirement date. So you'll have to, at some point, you're going to be outside of the government when your appointment is over. And you're subject, you have to be literally rehired by the department if you wish to return, say, to your line assistant United States attorney position. And you're subject to hiring freezes, budget constraints, and all kinds of other issues that could just be unfortunate at the time that you have to step down as U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
So there are some risks there, I suppose.
So yes, also one of the things to think about would be, all right, on one day you're basically dealing with actual cases. You're actually intimately involved in various cases. But all of a sudden, once you are the U.S. attorney, you're actually overseeing a whole office of attorneys. So how does that role change for you? Because you can't really afford to be intimately involved in a particular case as much as you are when you are actually, you know, the career attorney, the staff attorney, shall we say.
No, that's exactly right. And that is a big change, of course. And I had the luxury, if you will, of being first assistant initially. And I think that helped the transition a lot. It helped me learn the district, learn the office, get to know the various law enforcement entities that we primarily dealt with in that U.S. Attorney's office. And most importantly, it afforded me an opportunity to know my staff. As I should explain that as the first assistant, you are responsible for the day-to-day functioning and operations of the office. So you take that off the plate of the U.S. attorney, who has overarching authority and is the final decision maker of everything related to any decision that involves the office. But from a practical standpoint, as first assistant, the criminal chief, civil chief, and administrative officer answers to the first assistant. So you have oversight over these things in a firsthand way. You report to the U.S. attorney and follow his or her directions as the situation may demand. In terms of transitioning from having a caseload that's your own versus being effectively a manager of many attorneys, that's certainly challenging and can be frustrating at times. It's kind of, I imagine, I've never been a coach, but I imagine it's kind of like being a coach versus a player, because as a player, you're in the game and you're executing everything, all the rules, all the acts. As the coach, you're on the sideline. You told the player what to do, but you cannot act it out. And this plays itself out in presentations to the grand jury and trial performances and in appellate arguments. So it can be very enlightening in a lot of ways, because you do have a much bigger picture view of what goes on in the office, in the district, in terms of have your finger on the pulse of what's going on the civil side and the criminal side. And unimportantly, the administrative side of the office. So that's a big transition. You're not doing the job alone. I should very much add that. There are a lot of people you depend on. And the thing that I think strikes a lot of folks when they become senior people like a first assistant or U.S. attorney in a United States Attorney's office, no matter what district, is the amount of responsibility and power that you yield, you wield. It can be daunting. And also, I think the other thing that strikes you is when you had your own caseload, those were your issues and you could tackle them, grapple with them, and address them however you want. At your own pace. But when you're supervising a team of attorneys, all of the issues become ultimately your issues in some way as the supervisor. And you know, not every case is being equal. You alluded to this earlier, which cases do you get involved with? There's certainly some cases that are more routine than others. And certainly there were high profile cases that we dealt with in the Virgin Islands office. Many of them involving public corruption, public corruption, there was drug trafficking and a host of other things, including environmental crimes that were pretty serious things that transpired during my tenure, at least. So it's a lot to learn in a short amount of time. But again, right. You're not the Lone Ranger and you're not doing it by yourself. Yeah. You very much have to depend on your staff, and there are very good people in the office that may do it. So.
Well, let me ask this question, because it's something you prompted in an exchange we had, and that is, well, the U.S. Virgin Islands, those little islands, it's not a state. You know, it's not Missouri, it's not Delaware, it's not New York. They're the group of islands that, yes, subject to the United States, but in fact, they're not a state. So does that raise or bring challenges to how you can do things as from a legal perspective?
It does. And it's maybe for those who may not be familiar with the Virgin Islands, just in terms of its topography, location, and et cetera, it's in the Lesser Antilles. That probably means not a lot to a lot of people, but it's 50 miles to the east of Puerto Rico. And the Virgin Island is made up of three primary islands, St. Thomas, St. Croix, which is 40 miles north and about twice the size of St. Thomas, but about the equal population, and St. John, which is just off the coast, about a 20-minute ferry ride from St. Thomas. And notably, 70% of St. John is national park. So it's a lot of it is pristine and beautiful and preserved. The beaches are absolutely breathtaking. And all the islands have beautiful beaches, I should say. But the fact that you're in a district with several islands, and I just named the larger islands. There are about 50 to 60 small islands. Some are just rocks, but some are bigger and have people on them that comprise the USVI. One of the biggest challenges to them is, you mentioned going from DC, being in AUSA, to the Virgin Islands, and I mentioned learning the district. One thing we did not have in DC were 360-degree borders. And that changes a lot of things. And it's 360-degree borders several times over that have to be defended. The Caribbean is a unique place with many different territories and countries. And there are a lot of things going on, good and bad, down there. There's drug trafficking, human trafficking that my office dealt with. There's money laundering. There's certainly gun trafficking. And all of these things create problems for folks just trying to, you know, live and have a good life. So those were things I certainly had to bring myself up to speed on. And it's probably worth noting that you didn't always have the resources that you would have liked to have had in addressing some of these problems too, because it is a remote district. And it's one of the smallest districts, if not the smallest, in the community of U.S. attorney's offices. So, and in my office, we actually had two offices, one in St. Thomas and one in St. Croix. I actually sat on St. Thomas, but historically the U.S. attorney has sat on either island. It really depends on where they start. But officially the main office is on St. Thomas, but it's, like I said, not unusual for the U.S. attorney to sit on St. Croix. I guess you also have the option to live on St. John, even though that would present some logistical difficulties sometimes, just because it is a ferry ride away, and sometimes the weather doesn't permit the ferry to go back and forth. You could get stuck on St. John and not be able to effectively do your job.
Well, given the fact that you're in that part of the world, and a lot of people would think about it as the Caribbean because people are aware of it from taking cruises, let's say, into the region and so on and so forth. But the other part of what I think might be different, and certainly this is why I'm raising this for you to elaborate on, is you have a lot of islands down there, and they belong to other countries, whether it's British, you know, Dutch, so on and so forth. So how is the interaction with, let's say, foreign governments different than if you were on the continental mainland U.S.?
I can only speak from my experiences in the USA and D.C. Where we did have some international cases in the D.C. office, for sure. In the Virgin Islands, it is virtually a daily occurrence. The British Virgin Islands is right next door. And while the colonial powers may have divided the islands in certain ways, the locals don't necessarily look at it that way. Many members of my staff would be in Tortola, which is the British Virgin Island, every weekend to see their relatives who were very close, and because they've been there for decades in that region of the world. And that becomes important when you start putting in a calculus of how drug trafficking organizations work. And, you know, the bad guys have relatives across international borders, and it behooves you as a law enforcement agent to work with your law enforcement counterparts in other countries. And for that reason, there was a lot of work that we did together with our counterparts. I mentioned the British Virgin Islands. We would work with the Royal Police there. Very much so with the Dutch and the French, who were in different parts of the Caribbean, further down island, as they say, as you talk down the Lesser Antilles, that chain of islands that leads to South America. You, as a necessity, become involved in various task forces and interagency groups in a combined effort to address some of the problems that are occurring down there. Drug trafficking, money laundering, and the like, human trafficking also. So that was something that was just a necessity in that part of the world. You know, I should say that it's not exclusive to that part of the world. There certainly were multi-agency task forces in different parts of the country. But I think one of the more unique things is that you would work closely with your Dutch, French, and British allies, and also relying on their intel and some of their equipment. For instance, there were, I know the Coast Guard had what's called a rider agreement with the British BVI, where some of our law enforcement personnel could ride or serve on their boats with basically peace officer status, where they can make arrests and of ongoing felonies and things of that sort, and vice versa. We also would have meetings periodically, or I should probably characterize that as regularly, with some of our task forces, where we would involve especially the British, because they were right next door. And we would share intel and have our priority list of targets, et cetera, et cetera. So it was, in terms of dealing with a foreign country or territory, it was a daily occurrence. Go ahead, Tim. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it sounds to me like, which is going to be different than if you were in the plain states of the United States. Here, you're actually involved a lot more of what I call international relations, but also probably sharing of intelligence with foreign officials and so on. So there's a lot more of that than one would see, let's say, in Iowa, I would guess.
And you know, a lot of it would go through your, you know, because you're the U.S. Attorney's Office, your jurisdiction is the U.S. Virgin Islands, and you apply U.S. law. So a lot of the intel and coordination with foreign governments would be with our law enforcement agencies, the DEA, ATF, Homeland Security, and the FBI. So they would spearhead a lot of these things because, you know, I mean, I'm just a lawyer after all. So And, you know, they are actually the personnel out there making the cases, if you
will. Yeah.
So, but they also need guidance in terms of what they can and can't do to have a case that can be tried in a U.S. court and can withstand appellate scrutiny. So that was primarily my role as legal advisor.
Yeah. You said a little while ago about the being in the U.S. Virgin Islands, there's some great stuff and bad stuff. And sadly, I mean, you, as a lawyer and as a U.S. attorney, you're usually only dealing with the bad stuff, right?
That's true. But remember, I should point out the priority of the U.S. Attorney's Office is to protect American lives.
Yeah.
And that means a lot of things. And it also means building community trust and things of that sort. So we had in our office we made a lot of efforts to build that trust, because one of the things I should have talked about earlier, when you mentioned what's different about being in a territory than a state, mm-hmm. There's a bit of a rub there, because they're not a state, but they're not independent either.
Right.
So it's a love-hate relationship sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think one of the ways to look at the Virgin Islands is to look at it as the U.S.'s southern border. In terms of when you may be able to make some comparisons to when the continental United States was expanding west,
mm-hmm.
and territories there. And you had federal personnel there enforcing the laws, and you know, you had a local government, which is certainly true in the Virgin Islands. But you know, sometimes things would get bad. It's like, well, what are the feds doing about this? And other times, it's like, well, butt out, because with an attitude of he's a thief, but he's our thief. So there was always that bit of a rub there sometimes. And I think it was, I tried my best to build bridges, in terms of communicating with local, officials, local law enforcement, the local AG, the Virgin Islands Police Department, include them. We certainly had, fully vetted task force officers from the Virgin Islands Police Department that worked closely and were embedded with our federal law enforcement agencies to try to build these types of bridges and I should probably mention some of the agencies and I'm not limiting the task force officers to these, but certainly in the FBI, DEA, and ATF.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that was, I think, you know, really important to help the office function, because you got to understand a lot of my staff was local. It was probably 50-50 mix between what is referred to locally in the Virgin Islands as continentals, which I would be, versus folks from the Virgin Islands. So that was a challenge in a lot of ways to build those bridges. And I mentioned building community trust earlier. And one of the things that people tend to put prosecutors in a box, like you just lock folks up and throw them away or whatever. And that's, well, you know, it's certainly an important part of the job is to enforce the laws, but your job is to administer justice.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly doesn't always dictate locking someone up indefinitely or seeking the highest penalty possible. More often than not, that's a rare request from the government.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think one of the things that is important, and it's not just me that tried to do this in my district, but there were others, certainly U.S. attorneys at the time that did this. You try to give the federal government a face.
Yes.
And for a lot of people in the Virgin Islands, they're aren't a whole lot of federal offices down there. So their interaction with the federal government, a lot of it is with law enforcement. That's the face of the federal government to them.
Yeah.
And so we did a fair amount of outreach, going to community meetings, working with NGOs, mm-hmm. And a lot of it involved drug prevention and alternatives. And there's several programs that were pre-existing before I got there.
Yeah.
But for my office, I established a just something I learned while I was in D.C. So I'm not above stealing ideas, but when transplanting, it was what I did. But one of the things we did, we had it in D.C. We used to go to a local school and, mm-hmm. and just mentor the kids there. It was challenging because you had a heavy caseload and things of that sort.
Yeah.
So I said, well, what similar thing can I do here while I'm U.S. attorney? So we established a program with the Boys and Girls Club in St. Thomas, and it worked mostly in St. Thomas. We tried to implement it in St. Croix, but that's a bit of a smaller office, so it was more challenging there. We also created a community outreach initiative, which involved members of federal law enforcement and various NGOs that were already working in the community. And for many, we would go in public housing places with the Virgin Islands Housing Authority,
yeah,
and field questions. It was just a forum for people to talk and mm-hmm. talk to us about what they're facing, because you know it's many more citizens than law enforcement, and they could easily be our eyes and ears, and would be much better because they're in more places. And of course, you have the no snitching rule and all that, but you know, you can get past that with a little effort, I think.
Yeah.
And I think one of the important things was that on the back end of that, you really are talking to what are potential jurors too. So the other thing is, you don't want the first time they see a federal official or say an FBI agent, they've never seen one in their life, and then they see him on the stand testifying and they're in the jury box, that's probably not the best look.
Yeah.
So you kind of take the face, you know, you pull the curtain back on the wizard a bit and just go out to the community, talk to them. And a lot of the things that they would bring up, we really address.
Yeah.
We talk about the lights have been out here forever. You know, can we get somebody to fix that? People speed through the neighborhood. Or the trash hasn't been picked up, or the bushes need to be cut back because I don't feel safe walking. Now, those aren't anything that any of our federal agencies do.
Right.
I could use my, if you will, convening power as U.S. attorney and talk to VIPD about putting speed bumps in.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to the housing authority about trimming back the trees, getting the lights back on, or cutting the bushes. Or picking the trash up is what I meant to say. So it's, you know, that was important on the local level, which is kind of where all your energy comes from, is your home office. So,
yeah.
You know, and I think it led to, you know, I don't have any empirical evidence to support this, but I'd like to think that it helped with some of our convictions down there in terms of some of the more challenging cases that were successful.
Yeah, I think that what you're mentioning there with the at that local level, it's basically just general public safety, right?
Mm-hmm.
Better lighting in certain areas and speed bumps to slow the traffic down, make it so that it's safer for kids and pedestrians and everybody in general. So it's just a small element, but it's a big thing for people that live right there.
Exactly.
And it's basic public safety. So it is contributing to the overall in a positive way. I think you're right. I mean, a lot of times, you know, people see whether it's the federal government writ large or various agencies in a negative light because that's the only thing they see. And you know, I remember actually back when I was still in the government, and this is before we had CBP, but it was just plain old ordinary customs back in those days.
Right.
Getting a call from one of our offices up in Detroit. And I remember the question being, can we stop outbound passengers? And before I answered that question, I said, is there a specific situation? Because my initial thought was, I don't want customs officers in the airports just harassing people because they got nothing better to do. And I said, what's the situation? I mean, is there a specific issue going on or what? And it was, no, it's just a general question. And I thought, well, before I give somebody a green light just to harass people because they're just not busy or have nothing else to do, I thought, no, I'm not going to give them that green light, because all of a sudden they'll be harassing people all the time if I do that. So I was really careful about getting more information before just answering that question to the person up in Detroit, because you know, there were a lot of international flights and they just wanted to see if, oh, can we do stuff? Do what exactly, and what are the circumstances? And it kind of goes to what you're saying about trying to project a more positive image, if you can, to the general public, because they don't often have that kind of interaction that's positive. Mm-hmm. You know, most of their interaction might be viewed as negative just because of what they see on the news or elsewhere. So I think you hit a very important point there about the positive contribution in a public safety aspect. Great right. thing.
Right. And you know, this may not be intuitive for your audience. The U.S. Virgin Islands is outside of the U.S. customs zone. So you have to clear customs to go in and out, which from a law enforcement standpoint presents opportunities like you identify. So you can have enhanced searches, so to speak, versus what you can do stateside.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. You don't want to do it in a way that harasses people.
Yeah.
And we certainly did enhanced searches, but typically they involve searching certainly packages, the mail, and luggage. And we would screen them, and there was a lot of contraband found.
Yeah.
And this also led to a lot of our public corruption prosecutions, because these things were being facilitated by local and federal personnel working at the airports or the post office, et cetera.
Yeah.
So but you don't want you don't want to put a chilling effect on people traveling.
No.
First of all, because that's their bread and butter. That's their primary industry is tourism.
Yeah.
And people want to have a positive experience when they travel and not feel like they're living in a police state. So targeted searches was the priority. Yep. And like you said, if you can give me a reason or a specific plan going forward and what you're trying to accomplish, then you know, I certainly signed off on those.
Yeah. No, it's and these with all the technology these days, the ability to target better than mm-hmm. back when I was working at customs, which has been now quite a few years ago. You know, the tools are there better, and technology certainly has improved to do the targeting, so that you can hopefully reduce the amount of unnecessary searches that you need to do. I mean, obviously, there's going to be some random stuff, but generally speaking, look, all these guys are busy. They don't want to waste time on a target that really is not going to amount to anything. And so they really want to have their odds improved by going, you know, looking into someone's luggage or packaging that they think actually will produce a result, right? Mm-hmm. We've got too much stuff coming across the border or coming into a territory to waste time on other stuff. So it's the volume is ridiculously high and it's too much. Just curious, any just random other thoughts that may be interesting to people about U.S. attorneys in general these days? I mean, I think you've given us a lot on the basics.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot there. It's a challenging job, but very rewarding at the end of the day, I think. There are so many things out of your control that you're trying to orchestrate, come up with strategies and priorities for the office.
Right.
And coordinate those strategies, hopefully they mesh with the priorities of your law enforcement agencies. So there's a lot of work that you have to do on that diplomatic level within the federal government, if you will. Just getting the support so that, you know, the folks that are actually doing the investigations are you know, targeting things that you see as the priorities. So that's a challenge. I think in terms of just anecdotally, I think at the end of the day, you really feel like you're trying to accomplish something. And I think to the U.S. attorney, I don't know if there's anyone that left the job feeling like they can say, okay, I'm done. I did what I had to do. There's always so much more that you can do and things that are going to not be completed on your watch. but you have to pass the baton at some point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And hopefully things, the momentum keeps up.
Yeah. Now, well, it's been a very interesting conversation, Ron. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And hopefully, you know, those who will pop in and watch and listen to what the conversation has covered will go away with something more than they, you know, they'll know more than at the beginning of this and have a little more depth of understanding of what that job is, not just for the U.S. attorney, but also that whole staff that has to deal with all the various things that go on in any particular jurisdiction and many things they have to really handle as far as protecting the public, both in a positive way, negative ways. I mean, they've got to deal with it all. And it's a very all-consuming, time-consuming job. So thank you very much for enlightening us today. And it was great to see you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Tim, for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. Yeah.
Thank you, Ronald. Wow, what a fascinating history and insight. It's incredible. So thank you for your service and for all the work you've done. And thank you, Tim Trainer, for hosting Tim's Travails here on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, where you can watch the video version, Spotify, iHeart, and Apple. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, the proud producer of the show, and we look forward to seeing you next month for episode 14. We'll see y'all soon.